From the University of Virginia's Karsh Institute, this is Democracy in Danger. I'm Will Hitchcock. Siva is away this week.
We are following some breaking news and taking you now right away to Kansas City, Missouri, where the county prosecutor is giving an update on the
last month, a shooting at the Kansas City Super Bowl parade shocked the country.
The rally had just ended, maybe about 10 minutes or so, when we saw the chaos.
Or did it? We've grown almost to expect this sort of gun violence, sadly.
For their lives. And then we heard sirens.
In America, according to law enforcement statistics, there are, on average, every day, two mass shootings. That's defined as a shooting with four or more casualties.
Killed a woman and injured 20 others. Police say the incident started with a verbal argument, quickly escalating when one of the suspects pulled a gun and began firing.
In 2023, there were 656 of these. The same year, about 43,000 people died from gun violence, many of those by suicide. It's a terribly morbid fact to state, but here goes. In the 30 minutes while y'all are listening to this podcast, someone will die from gunfire in America.
I couldn't see the shooters because of the wall of people that were coming at me. Again, I was about 35 yards away from when it happened, but police officers from all directions ran that way, and they ended up tackling a couple of people, it appears, but that's the way it looked to me. I didn't
A few seasons ago, we talked with historian Carol Anderson about the racist underpinnings of the Second Amendment, a provision of our founding law that drives so much of the conversation about guns. But today we're turning to the political culture of firearms in the present and in the recent past. We've invited two experts on this issue to talk about it. Historian Andrew McKevitt is on the line from Louisiana Tech University. His latest book is Gun Country, Gun Capitalism, Culture, and Control in Cold War America. And we have sociologist Jennifer Carlson with us from Arizona State University. She's a 2022 MacArthur Fellow and the author of the recent book, Merchants of the Right, Gun Sellers and the Crisis of Democracy. Jenny, Drew, a warm welcome to you both.
Hi, Will. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for having me.
Drew, let me start with you. And I am intrigued by the subtitle of your book in which you use the phrase gun capitalism. I want to ask you what that phrase means, how you use it in your book. What can that do for us to illuminate the broader crisis that this topic?
Yeah, I think the most important thing to keep in mind when we talk about gun history is change over time. So much American thinking about guns is rooted in static ideas about guns going back to the 18th century. So when I talk about gun capitalism, I'm talking about the production, sourcing, importation, distribution, marketing, and retailing of firearms. And I'm interested in the way that changed in the United States after the Second World War. Something like gun capitalism existed at least back to the mid-19th century when it's created by a host of entrepreneurs with famous names like Colt and Winchester. These are the figures who not only master the mass production of firearms, but more importantly, the marketing of firearms. And so much of their marketing is responsible for the creation of foundational myths about guns in America. And so my argument is that gun capitalism changes in the post-war era, and it's thanks to a new cohort of gun capitalists, people with names who've mostly receded into the past, who help recreate gun capitalism, who help to build a truly mass consumer market for firearms in a country that, after 1945, finds itself in a preeminent position globally, and a population that's experiencing the economic effects of global predominance. Just to throw a few numbers out there, basic numbers. In 1945, the end of the war, as best we can tell, there are about 45 million guns in civilian hands in the United States. Today, we're talking about 450 million, 10 times as many guns in a population that only grew about a quarter of that rate. And what we see after 1945 is the doubling of the gun stockpile every 25 years or so. So how do we make sense of that? I don't think the Second Amendment or gun tradition helps explain that, because those things have always been there. Why does gun accumulation accelerate so dramatically after the Second World War? And I argue that it's that cohort of gun capitalists who find new sources of cheap guns and who exploit new ways of marketing and selling them to a population flush with rising incomes and leisure time, and eventually one that's going to become suspicious and fearful of dangers lurking outside their doors.
Jenny, that's a great opening to ask you a little bit about how capitalism has intersected with politics in our contemporary culture. We'll come back to Drew and his historical framing, but just talk a little bit about your work and how you've connected the selling, the marketing, the branding of guns with the way it's impacted, warped perhaps, our political culture, in particular right-wing political culture.
Yeah, I think Drew's work is so incredible in terms of giving us sort of the lay of the land and these broad sort of socioeconomic dynamics that are unfolding over the course of the 20th century. And what my work does is really try and get at what is happening on the ground, you know, not just the system of gun capitalism, but the practice of it. And whether you love it or hate it, what is genius about the contemporary gun rights movement is the way that it's knitted together gun politics, gun culture, and gun markets. So to buy a gun, to own a gun, to carry a gun is to participate in a culture. It is a political act. Of course, it is embedded in a market. And so what that means is that gun stores themselves obviously are market entities, but they're also functioning as political spaces. They are spaces where politics gets debated. There are spaces where politics gets forged, where politics gets practiced. And I really got at this through the conversations that I had with gun sellers for my book. I interviewed them during 2020 during this massive surge in gun purchasing that happened. One of the things that I always ask them, you know, tell me about interacting with these new customers. How do you, you know, how do you get a sense of their politics? How do you know that, you know, a new gun buyer is a new gun buyer? And so, you know, gun sellers would tell me about, you know, the conversations they'd strike, how they'd get at people's politics, and, you know, really how they understood themselves as promoting a particular kind of politics, both about guns themselves, but also, and again, this is in the context of 2020, the pandemic, resisting the state and resisting public health guidance and what have you. They would tell me stories of, you know, first-time gun buyers being, you know, surprised and upset and, you know, couldn't believe that there's a waiting period or that they had to go through some kind of, you know, background checks or some other kind of check or sort of some other kind of bureaucratic hoop, as gun sellers might call it, to get a gun. And so, you know, they would use that moment as sort of a way to sort of, you know, present this argument about gun control, which I think is super fascinating because obviously people who are policymakers who are promoting, for example, universal background checks, they're not thinking about this as opening up a moment for gun sellers then to politicize, you know, the would-be gun buyer, the would-be pro-gun advocate.
Yeah. It's so interesting to think about that retail relationship, you know, the conversations that are happening right there at the counter. Drew, let me just zoom back a little bit again to the politics and American culture. The Cold War is sort of an accelerant. Is it fuel to the creation of America as a gun country? How did that work?
Yeah, there are lots of ways that the Cold War helps make the United States the gun country that it is today. First is that the Cold War indirectly helps flood the country with cheap guns, helping to make a mass consumer market. These are war surplus imports. These are mostly rifles coming from Europe and Asia, guns that had been used on battlefields during the Second World War that end up in the United States retailing in some cases for as little as 10% the cost of a brand new hunting rifle from an established U.S. manufacturer like a Remington or Winchester or something like that. After the war, this cohort of gun capitalists exploits this surplus of arms sitting unused. They're picking up guns for less than a dollar each in places like Finland and Spain and Italy. And governments there are happy to get rid of them. By the late 1950s, the importers are bringing in hundreds of thousands of rifles like this each year. And eventually Congress is going to take notice, right? And in 1957, there's some back and forth over just trying to figure out the basics of what's happening here and considering what Congress might do about it. They hear from the State Department, which has the power to restrict these imports, but tells them it has not restricted these imports. And essentially bringing guns into the United States, at least for the State Department in the Eisenhower era, is good Cold War policy. It's better for the world's firearms to flood into the United States, the State Department says, than for those guns to trickle out into the hands of communist insurgents around the world. Mm. Secondly, I argue that it's in a kind of Cold War ideology that we find the origins of this radical, absolutist, no compromise interpretation of the Second Amendment so common on the right of American politics today. This kind of thinking gets supercharged in the 1950s and 1960s by the Cold War, which now seemingly presents existential threats to the individual. And with the social upheavals of the 1960s, especially the Black urban uprisings in places like Watts and Detroit and Newark, those existential threats appear to conservatives and even to people further to the right to be right on their doorsteps. And so the threat of communist subversion, which to many on the right morphs into these Black uprisings in the 1960s, this is what supercharges this radical understanding of the Second Amendment. And as gun sales explode in the 1960s, it's going to reach a wider audience eager to hear it. And eventually in the 1970s, it becomes a kind of gospel for the mainstream gun rights movement embodied in the National Rifle Association.
Funny you mentioned the National Rifle Association. One of my trophies from summer camp were the badges that we used to get and could sew onto our clothing to indicate we had learned how to use a rifle and that we'd moved up the ranks. It was like having a different karate belts. I had those things pinned to my corkboard in, you know, mid-70s suburban America, and I think millions of kids do. That's how we were socialized into it. So it started early. Jenny, I'm interested in another phenomenon from that era, which is, you know, this is, as Drew is talking about it, we have this spike in the availability of arms. We also have a social and political crisis from the late 60s onward. This is also when the conservative movement in America is really starting to get traction as well. How do these things interact?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And, you know, I think one of the really interesting aspects of the, you know, pandemic surge in gun purchasing was that, you know, people who were not the quote unquote traditional gun owners were buying guns in greater and greater numbers. So people outside of the white conservative male profile. That being said, though, when we look at, you know, how gun politics takes shape as a political project, very much we see this tighter and tighter wedding between conservative politics, particularly the Republican Party and sort of mainstream or establishment gun politics. And there are many gun lobbying organizations beyond the National Rifle Association, although the National Rifle Association, for a variety of reasons, tends to kind of suck the oxygen out of the room with regard to, you know, setting the agenda and setting that, you know, making gun politics, not just gun politics, but conservative gun politics. I think obviously what's going on in terms of current trials that the NRA is facing, there's a big question of what the future of the NRA is and whether and how it will continue to shape gun politics. But I think there's this culture piece that often gets overlooked. And I think you just referred to it with regard to, you know, shooting competitions and that sort of thing. You know, a big part of what the NRA does is not just act as a political lobbyist. It acts as the major firearms training organization in the United States. And so, you know, this is crucial to understanding not just, you know, gun politics in general, but how people learn to relate to their guns, right? And so I saw this when I did field work in Michigan on concealed carry and attended NRA training. I became an NRA certified instructor, and very much this idea of guns, you know, not just being vehicles of self-defense, but really making you a particular kind of person, a good person, someone who cares about your own safety, your family's safety, your community's safety. This is why when I write about gun politics and write about citizenship, it's really pertinent to think about how gun politics, particularly concealed carry culture, gun carry culture, has placed the willingness to use defensive lethal force as ever more central to our understandings of citizenship. So, you know, I think that the NRA has had these kind of layered impacts on our political system, how we think about the politics of guns, but also how people relate to guns. And I think, you know, when we talk about like what's going to happen to the NRA, I think it's those deeper cultural currents that the NRA has shaped that are going to be the most lasting and significant.
You know, Drew, when amateurs like us, like me, talk about, you know, the gun problem, we tend to have the notion that there's just this kind of, you know, avalanche. It's all been downhill. It's been bad from the beginning. Guns started to become available, and here we are washing guns. But actually, there's a narrative, a political narrative here. We have had gun regulation in America. We decided to get rid of much of it, but we've had a long history of experiments, federal and state control and registration and so forth. Why did we reach out for those efforts at control? Why was there a moment when Americans said, yeah, of course we have to have some kind of, you know, rules and regulations around guns? And then what happened?
Yeah, so that moment comes in the post-war era. The first moment comes in the 1960s. There's a brief moment in the 1930s where we get some federal lawmaking around sort of gangland violence. But really in the post-war era, it comes in the 1960s. And most importantly, in 1968 with the Gun Control Act of 1968, which does a number of things. It prohibits gun sales through the mail across state lines. But I think most importantly, what it does is it, or what it tried to do, was to limit civilian stockpiles of all kinds of firearms by restricting the importation of war surplus weapons, so that flow will be cut off in 1968. And it also cuts off a flow of cheap handguns made in Europe and elsewhere. And it's those cheap handguns that seem to become really a social problem in the 1960s. As for the Gun Control Act, it's remarkable that it passes at all, given how sensitive of a political topic guns already were in the 1960s. It's remarkable that it was so wide-ranging as it tried to be. But ultimately, it didn't make anybody happy. Critics on the left said that it didn't go far enough, while critics on the right said that it was a slippery slope toward confiscation and totalitarianism.
But wait a minute. Wouldn't there have been those on the right who said, you got to keep guns out of the hands of criminals? It's a law and order matter. Was that part of the debate?
Well, that's right. And you know, that's the political alliance that forms in 1968 that is a precursor to the law and order a politics of Nixon that come together and say, finally, we've got to get something done here. And so it's very much a bipartisan bill when it passes Congress. But people on the right, further to the right, the people who become absolutist gun rights activists in the 1970s and thereafter, this is a watershed moment for them as well. But after parts of the bill pass in the summer of 1968, Lyndon Johnson tries to push through registration and licensing, but he's run out of political capital. He's a lame duck president at that point, and nobody's got the stomach left for another fight over guns. And so for a quarter century, we're stuck with the Gun Control Act of 1968 until we get revisions to it in 1993 and 94 with things like the Brady Bill and the assault weapons ban.
So, Jenny, when I ride along Route 66 in Washington, D.C., I pass the National Rifle Association's headquarters. They're out there in Northern Virginia. And I always think, boy, those guys are in trouble these days. They're bankrupt. They are besieged by legal problems. But maybe this is a case of declaring victory and going out of business. Have they won the game, even though they seem to be in trouble? Where are they today? And what does that tell us about where the gun debate and gun problem is today?
Yeah, I mean, I think anyone betting against the NRA, I think they need to step back. They need to take a beat. You know, this reminds me very much of what happened in the early 90s when we had the assault weapons ban. You know, this was declared this major victory for the gun violence prevention movement. And really, this was, you know, this major moment where the NRA was able to galvanize and really adopt a level of, you know, aggressive rhetoric, really kind of double down on so much of what we sort of take for granted as the hardline ethos of the NRA. But, you know, these moments of sort of seeming victory by the gun control side generally are not, they generally get mobilized very differently from within the gun rights movement. They're don't ever assume the NRA is done. You know, I think that this political style, the way of engaging in politics, you know, when we go back to this idea of the slippery slope, even, this is a fundamentally conspiracist way of thinking about politics, right? So it's the idea that no matter how innocuous, benign, seemingly consensus-oriented a particular policy might be, lurking behind is always an attempt at confiscation, right? And I think that when we kind of take that forward, we really see how this sort of deep suspicion, deep polarization, and again, I don't even think polarization even really gets at it, because it's writing, you know, it's writing your political opponents out of sort of the political playbook almost. So there's so much to sort of tease out in terms of the NRA's impact on how we do politics. But I think that's a really, how they have sort of weaponized partisanship has really not just impacted how we think about guns, but also how we engage with democracy more broadly.
That is an entry point, Jenny. I want to ask you to talk a little bit about gun culture and democracy. On the one hand, maybe you could say, hey, look, you know, we have a democracy and we have lots of guns. Clearly, this means that Americans want lots of guns. Mm-hmm. But lots and lots of data suggests that Americans have fairly nuanced views or somewhat sophisticated views about guns, which are not reflected in our legislation. Why? What's wrong?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a lot of ways to unpack the relationship between guns and democracy. So, you know, the most basic way that I think you've just alluded to is, you know, is democracy, is our democratic system actually capturing what people want in terms of gun policy, right? When we look at, you know, the numbers on, you know, whether Americans at large are satisfied with our gun laws, no, they're not, you know, in the majority. But then there's also this deeper question of what guns and gun politics and gun culture do to how we practice democracy. What does it do to how we engage and understand ourselves as democratic citizens? But when we look at liberal gun owners of today, when we look at the history of, you know, emancipatory and liberatory politics that have been attached to guns at different moments, we can actually see and sort of open our eyes to the possibility that this sort of relationship between gun politics, conservative politics, and democracy actually isn't inevitable. And so we are a country awash with guns. Guns are durable objects. Attrition is very low when it comes to guns. We have more guns than people. I think that, and this is what I think Drew's book is really powerful at showing us, is that there might have been a moment in American history where this idea of abolishing guns could have been practically, if not politically feasible, but we're past that moment. And so I think the challenge to us is to recognize, you know, I did not choose this gun context. None of us alive, most of us alive, did not do, are not the reason that we exist in this dilemma that we have today. As much as, you know, people talk about banning guns, repealing the Second Amendment, and so on and so forth, I think forging a different kind of gun culture and reimagining the relationship between guns and democracy is really the hard challenge that we have, rather than, you know, frankly, reinforcing this very toxic political divide that we have surrounding guns.
Drew, you agree with that?
Yeah, undoubtedly. I mean, I think that's the fundamental question, right? We're now in a country of 450 million guns. It's no longer a country in which we can talk about controlling the guns. That's why nobody uses that term gun control anymore. It was a strategic shift in some ways, but it's also a practical sense in that you're not going to be able to control the guns. All you can do is keep yourself safe from the guns. That's why we talk about gun safety, and why I think, you know, Jennifer is absolutely right that the thing we need to focus on is how we build a true and real and functioning democracy in a society of 500 million guns, because the two may not be compatible, but we've got to figure out a way to make it happen.
Just let me wrap up by asking you each kind of where we started at the beginning, you know, yet another tragedy in the headlines. Why does gun violence not ever seem to move the needle with respect to the gun safety debate? What is the reason for that? Is it simply numbness? Is it that our political positions are too extreme and they've been staked out? What you would think at one point there's a breaking point, but what I hear both of you saying is don't look for a breaking point.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I've been on panels where, you know, another panelist will say something like, you know, at some point there's going to be a mass shooting that is so bad, that is so egregious that we have no choice but to act. And that mass shooting has come and gone many, many times. So the idea that Americans are going to be galvanized by the pain and suffering of one another is something that a variety of social movements have banked on. And, you know, we can look at the Black Lives Matter movement. We can look at, obviously, the gun violence prevention movement. We can look at other movements historically and at present. And this is not something that has reliably galvanized Americans. So I think that there's something we really have to reckon with in terms of our ability to, frankly, at the most basic level, care for one another. I think that one of the issues that comes to my mind in terms of the gun debate is how this debate, you know, it's obviously not addressing this issue, but is it actually making it harder for us to address the issue, right? Is it dividing us further and further so that not only are we not addressing the issue, but we're making it all the more impossible that we will. you know, the gun rights side has long been the purveyors of partisanship in this debate. And when we look at sort of what has galvanized the gun violence prevention movement, you know, when we compare these groups across, you know, over the last few decades, we can see that there's been sustained mobilization among gun rights advocates. But the mobilization among gun violence prevention advocates, as we all know, has been much more sporadic. It's you know, event oriented. It's not sustained. That's changing. So there's actually evidence that the gun violence prevention movement is giving rise to sustained mobilization. So the question then is, at what cost? Well, here's the cost, is that there's at least some evidence, and this is a new paper actually by Kristen Goss and Matthew Lacombe, that shows that it's actually the gun violence prevention side really embracing partisanship, being galvanized by partisanship. So it's not just, you know, disgust and mobilization surrounding the issue of gun violence. It's hating the Republican Party. It's attaching gun violence prevention to being, you know, mobilizing against the Republican Party. This is why at the end of my book, I talk about liberal gun owners actually as possible, you know, possible bridgers to these very increasingly polarized sides, simply because I think that's the kind of work that we need to figure out how to do. And I'm just very concerned that the terms of our gun debate, as they are now, are not going to get us there.
It sounds like our democracy has to become more polarized, Drew, in order to have any breakthroughs on gun legislation.
Yeah, well, I think Jennifer's right. In the wake of these mass shootings, not only do we hear that outrage and that heartbreak, but we also see gun sales go up, gun sales spike in the wake of each one of these disasters. And that only reaffirms more the power of the gun rights movement. But at the same time, it also mobilizes not just political will and initiative among the grassroots to do something about it, but it sets in motion the wheels of a gun control movement that is as entrenched in Washington politics today and as tightly linked to that liberal Democratic Party as the NRA is to the conservative Republican Party. You know, that cycle is one that needs to be broken as well. And I'm ultimately not sure how to do it.
Well, Drew and Jenny, this is an amazing conversation about a crucial and urgent issue in our lives. Thank you so much for joining us on Democracy in Danger.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks, Will.
Jennifer Carlson is a professor of sociology at Arizona State University and a 2022 MacArthur Fellow. She writes widely on the place of firearms in the United States, and her latest book is Merchants of the Right. Andrew C. McKevitt is the John D. Winters Endowed Professor of History at Louisiana Tech University. He studies and teaches about the Cold War era, and he's the author of the 2023 book, Gun Country. That's going to do it for this episode of Democracy in Danger. Stay in touch. Shoot us a tweet at DND Podcast, that's D-I-N-D Podcast, and visit our webpage, dindanger.org. The show is produced by Robert Armengol, Nicholas Scott, Stephen Betts, and Ariana Aronson. Adine Yeager engineers the show. Our interns are Charlie Burns, Lena Frehat, Katie Pyle, Makhdu Murad Shah, and Caroline Yu. We have help from Ellie Salvatierra. Support comes from the University of Virginia's College of Arts and Sciences. D&D is part of the Democracy Group podcast network, and we're a project of UVA's Karsh Institute of Democracy. We're distributed by the Virginia Audio Collective of WTJU Radio in Charlottesville. I'm Will Hitchcock, and Siva will be back with us in a couple of weeks. Take care.